great pleasure. A chance to hear again Dame Celia Johnston presenting a selection of her favourite poetry and prose in company with David Davis and Rosalind Shanks before an invited audience at the Kenton Theatre, Henley-on-Thames. Celia Johnston.
My peg to start with is with places which have delighted me, like the North Cornwall coast, where we've been going for years. We'll start with a poem of Kipling's, A Smuggler's Song. And here is a pleasure and delight. Mr. David Davis has a voice to charm the birds out of the trees, not only out of the trees, I dare say. And he is going to read it, A Smuggler's Song by Rudyard Kipling.
If you wake at midnight and hear a horse's feet, don't go drawing back the blind or look in the street. Them that asks no questions ain't told a lie. Watch the wall, me darling, while the gentlemen go by. 25 ponies trotting through the dark, brandy for the pass, baccy for the clerk. Laces for a lady, letters for a spy. And watch the wall, my darling, while the gentlemen go by. Running round the woodlump, if you chance to find little barrels roped and tarred all full of brandy wine, don't you shout to come and look, nor use them for your play. Put the brushwood back again, and they'll be gone next day. If you see the stable door setting open wide, if you see a tired horse lying down inside, if your mother mends a coat cut about and torn, if the lining's wet and warm, don't you ask no more. If you meet King George's men dressed in blue and red, you be careful what you say and mindful what is said. If they call you pretty maid and chuck you neath the chin, don't you tell where no one is, nor yet where no one's been. Knocks and footsteps round the house, whistles after dark, you've no call for running out till the house dogs bark. Trust is here and pinch is here, and see how dumb they lie. They don't fret to follow when the gentlemen go by. If you do as you've been told, likely there's a chance you'll be given a dainty doll all the way from France, with a cap of Valentine's and a velvet hood, a present from the gentleman, along of being good. 25 trotting through the dark, brandy for the parson, baccy for the clerk. Them that asks no questions isn't told a lie. Watch the wall, my darling, while the gentlemen go by.
Sir John Betjeman, whose home is Cornwall and who goes there frequently, brings it to one's mind so that one can smell and breathe it. I dare say you remember a poem about golf that he wrote, about golf at St. Enadoc, which is a golf course round that funny little tiny church with a twisted spire, which is known locally as Sinkininny. It's called Sinkininny because it was bedded by sand at one point and the clergyman had to be dropped in through the roof to keep it consecrated. I don't play golf very often, but I do remember a family foursome there a few years ago, when I'm sorry to say we laughed so helplessly that we had to lie down in the bunkers. Well, to hide our unsuitable laughter from the proper earnest golfers. This poem, read by another charmer called Rosalind Shanks, is a rather frightening description of those fearsome cliffs on an autumn day with, most unusually, no wind. It's called Tregardock.
A mist that from the moor arose in sea fog wraps Port Isaac Bay. The moan of warning from Trevose makes grimmer this October day. Only the shore and cliffs are clear. Gigantic slithering shelves of slate in waiting awfulness appear like journalism, full of hate. On the steep path, a bramble leaf stands motionless and wet with dew. The grass bends down, the bracken's brown, the grey-green gorse alone is new. Cautious my sliding footsteps go to quarried rock and dripping cave. The ocean, leaden still below, hardly has strength to lift a wave. I watch it crisp into its height and flap exhausted on the beach. The long surf, menacing and white, hissing as far as it can reach. The Dunlin do not move. Each bird is stationary on the sand, as if a spirit in it heard the final end of sea and land. And I, on my volcano edge, exposed to ridicule and hate, still do not dare to leap the ledge and smash to pieces on the slate.
Clinging to my peg, I'm now going to Greece, to be bewitched by the dolphins and the purple seas and the purple past, mixed with the scent of the wild flowers and herbs of the almost purple present. It's The Old Ships by James Elroy Flecker.
I have seen old ships sail like swans asleep beyond the village which men still call Tyre. With leaden age or cargoed, dipping deep for Famagusta and the hidden sun that rings black Cyprus for the lake of fire. And all those ships were certainly so old. Who knows how oft, with squat and noisy gun, questing brown slaves or Syrian oranges, the pirates Genoese hell raked them, till they rolled blood, water, fruit, and corpses up the hold. But now, through friendly seas they softly run, painted the mid-sea blue or shore-sea green, still patterned with the vine and grapes in gold. But I have seen, pointing her shapely shadows from the dawn, an image tumbled on a rose-swept bay, a drowsy ship of some yet older day, and, wonder's breath indrawn, thought I, who knows, but in that same, fished up beyond the ear, patched up new, stern painted brighter blue, that talkative, bald-headed seaman came, 12 patient comrades sweating at the oar, from Troy's doom-crimson shore. And with great lies about his wooden horse, set the crew laughing and forgot his course. It was so old a ship. Who knows? Who knows? And yet so beautiful. I watched in vain to see the mast burst open with a rose and the whole deck put on its leaves again.
Now the peg takes me home. I'm going to read an extract from my husband's work. He was a very witty man. It's self-explanatory, being about the head of a rhinoceros. It's from his book called My Aunt's Rhinoceros by Peter Fleming. You could just affix it to the wall above the stairs. This dominating position would not be incongruous if my house were a station hotel or a regimental depot. But to place so arresting a trophy in so prominent a position in a private house would, something tells me, be to ask for trouble, if not to offend against etiquette. Short of a socking great hole in the roof I can think of almost nothing about a house more absolutely certain to draw comment from a visitor than the stuffed head of a rhinoceros. If you had a signed photograph of the Queen on the mantelpiece, your visitor would note the fact silently. He would not give an exclamation of surprise or ask questions about how you got it. If you had a Ming vase or an early Picasso or a Khotan carpet, he might, if he knew about such things, in due course refer to them, but he would not be quite sure of his ground. "I've been admiring," he would say, "your carpet. Surely it's..." And you would admit, not without pride, that it was. The case of a rhinoceros head towering over your visitor the moment he stepped across your threshold would be entirely different. A policeman who'd come to arrest you on some grave charge might conceivably manage to say nothing about it, until perhaps he was accompanying you upstairs to superintend the packing of a few necessities. Everybody else would give tongue at once. If they were strangers and felt shy, the rhinoceros would provide a welcome method of breaking the ice. If they were old friends, they would lapse immediately into the facetious. If they were highly strung children, they might easily burst into tears. For the rhinoceros, though to my prejudiced eye there is something of the jolie laid about him, has a farouche and intimidating aspect. None of these things would really matter if one had shot, or better still, strangled the animal yourself. Everyone would assume, from the place of honour allotted to it, that this had been the case. "Pretty dangerous customers, aren't they?" the uninitiated would ask respectfully. "Can't use anything much more than a .450 on those chaps," the more knowledgeable would suppose. Then the truth would have to come out. One had not shot the rhinoceros oneself. One's aunt had shot it. So to speak, for you. "Oh, really?" the visitor would say, in a polite but rather thoughtful voice. Erect upon its massive shield, gazing eternally upwards at the roof, the rhinoceros head stands at the back of the garage like a sort of tip-tilted stalagmite. It's surrounded by a zareba of children's bicycles, empty bottles, garden hose, and damaged toboggans. The last stitches have given way, and it is splitting from the top of its skull to the base of its horn. Two pigeons roost on a bracket above it, with the inevitable consequences. I rather believe it harbours mice. However quickly I turn the headlights off when I drive into the garage at night, I'm aware of its small, baleful eye, set in those dragon-like folds of skin. Its fixed stare produces a feeling of inadequacy and guilt. Sometimes, in ruthless, almost spiteful moments, I decide to get rid of it. But how? You can't simply throw a rhinoceros head away, like an old sock or an empty tin. And it would take at least 2 days to dig a hole large enough to bury it in. So it stays in the garage and catches my eye whenever it gets the chance. Later. I am grateful to several readers who have written to point out that the horn of the rhinoceros commands a ready sale among Oriental manufacturers of aphrodisiacs. I am also grateful to a firm of brushmakers and silversmiths who made me an offer of 22 and sixpence a pound for the horn. I think I shall hang on to the thing for another decade or so. Call me a sentimental fool, if you will, but I have an idea that I'm on a rising market. I think I ought perhaps to tell you that it's still there. Now, the next is from a book called No Room in the Ark, by an old friend of ours called Alan Moorhead. I've been with him and his wife several times to Africa to look at the animals, which was wonderful because he knew a great, great deal about them. I remember on one occasion we were looking at the animals drinking at night at the waterhole, and there were all the gazelles and the deer and the giraffes and clustered round drinking in the spotlit pool. And then suddenly, from the back, almost like out of a back cloth, came some lions. And it was most extraordinary. It was exactly like when royalty arrives at a party. Everybody sort of slightly stopped talking, you know, and backed a little bit respectfully away. And really, before you could turn around, they'd all vanished. You could see why it's called the Pride of Lions. Now, this bit is about when he went on a safari to find gorillas. And they'd been climbing for days and days, not days, hours and hours and hours, very hot day. And he was absolutely, totally exhausted.
Let the others go on and see all the gorillas they wanted. The guides now adjured us to keep the strictest silence. And in fact, it was this silence that dominated all the last moments of our climb. It closed around one with a thick, palpable, drug-like heaviness, almost as if one's ears were stuffed with cotton wool, or one's sense of hearing had suddenly failed. Layer on layer of silence. And this void, this nothingness of sound, was suddenly torn apart by a single high-pitched, bellowing scream. It was bizarre to the point of nightmare. It was as if one had received a sudden, unexpected blow on the back of the head. As I stood there, heart thumping, transfixed with shock, one of the guides grabbed me by the arm and half dragged and half pushed me through the undergrowth towards a little rise where the others were standing. I looked at the point where they were staring, and I remember calling out aloud, "Oh, my God, how wonderful!" And the truth is that he was wonderful. He was a huge, shining male, half crouching, half standing, his mighty arms akimbo. I had not been prepared for the blackness of him. He was a great, craggy pillar of gleaming blackness, black crew-cut hair on his head, black, deep-sunken eyes glaring towards us, huge, rubbery, black nostrils, and a black beard. He shifted his posture a little, still glaring fixedly upon us, and he had the dignity and majesty of prophets. He was the most distinguished and splendid animal I ever saw, and I only had one desire at that moment: to go forward towards him, to meet him, and to know him, to communicate.
This is a poem called Future Work by Fleur Adcock. It took me hours to track it down and led me along a lot of rewarding but distracting roots. It's got a little sort of piece above it which says, "Please send future work," which is an editor's note on a rejection slip.
It's going to be a splendid summer. The apple tree will be thick with golden russets, expanding weightily in the soft air. I shall finish the brick wall beside the terrace and plant out all the geranium cuttings. Pinks and carnations will be everywhere. She will come out to me in the garden, her bare feet pale on the cut grass, bringing jasmine tea and strawberries on a tray. I shall be correcting the proofs of my novel, third in a trilogy, simultaneous publication in 4 continents. And my latest play will be in production at the Aldwych, starring Glenda Jackson and Paul Scofield, with Olivier Brilliant in a minor part. I shall probably have finished my translations of Persian creation myths and the pre-Socratics, drawing new parallels, and be ready to start on Lucretius. But first, I'll take a break at the chess championships in Manila. On present form, I'm fairly likely to win. And poems, Yes, there will certainly be poems. They sing in my head. They tingle along my nerves. It is all magnificently about to begin.
Now, Jane Austen. I didn't know what to do about Jane Austen. So I decided to read from her letters, which she wrote to her sister Cassandra, at a ball in Bath. There were people enough, I suppose, to have made 5 or 6 very pretty Basingstoke assemblies. I then got Mr. Evelyn to talk to, and Miss Twistleton to look at. And I am proud to say that I have a very good eye at an adulteress. For though repeatedly assured that another in the same party was the she, I fixed upon the right one from the first. A resemblance to Mrs. Lee was my guide. She's not as pretty as I expected. Her face has the same defect of baldness as her sister's, and her features not so handsome. She was highly rouged, and looked rather quietly and contentedly silly than anything else. Mrs. Badcock and 2 young women were of the same party, except when Mrs. Badcock thought herself obliged to leave them to run round the room after her drunken husband. His avoidance and her pursuit, with the probable intoxication of both, was an amusing scene. I've always liked poems that tell stories, and the next 2 poems tell stories. I read this one, The Queen's Marie, once when I was in Hong Kong, to some Chinese school children. They gazed at me with black, beautiful, unwinking eyes. They must have been astounded. I suppose it was only a proof, if proof were needed, of the bewildering idiocy of grown-ups. Why should I read them this? Anyhow, it's called The Queen's Marie. It's an old ballad. Marie Hamilton's to the kirk gane wi' ribbons in her hair. The king thought mair o' Mary Hamilton than ony that were there. Mary Hamilton's to the kirk gane wi' ribbons on her breast. The king thought mair o' Mary Hamilton than he listened to the priest. Mary Hamilton's to the kirk gane wi' gloves upon her hands. The king thought mair o' Mary Hamilton than the queen and all her lands. She hadna been about the king's court a month but barely ane, till she was beloved by all the king's court, and the king the only man. She hadna been about the king's court a month, but barely 3, till frae the king's court Mary Hamilton, durstna be. The king is to the abbey gane, to pull the abbey tree, to scale the babe frae Mary's heart, but the thing it wouldna be. Oh, she's rolled it in her apron, and set it on the sea. Gae sink ye, swim ye, bonny babe, ye get na mair o' me. Word is to the kitchen gane, and word is to the hall, and word is to the noble room among the ladies all, that Mary Hamilton's brought to bed, and the bonny babe's missed and awoke. Scarcely had she lain down again, and scarcely fallen asleep, when up and started our good queen just at her bed feet, saying, Mary Hamilton, where's your babe? For I'm sure I heard it greet. Oh, no. Oh, no, my noble queen. Think no sick thing to be. 'Twas but a stitch into my side, and, sair, it troubles me. Get up. Get up, Mary Hamilton. Get up and follow me. For I am going to Edinburgh too, and a rich wedding for to see. Oh, slowly, slowly raise she up, and slowly put she on, and slowly raise she out the way with many a weary groan. The queen was clad in scarlet, her merry maids all in green, and every tune that they came to, they took Mary for the queen. But little wist Mary Hamilton when she rode on the brown, that she was gane to Edinburgh toon, and ought to be put down. Why weep ye, say ye, burgess wives? Why look ye, say, on me? Oh, I'm going to Edinburgh town, a rich wedding to see. When she gaed up the tall booth stairs, the cocks frae her heels did flee. And long or ere she came down again, she was condemned to die. When she came to the Netherbow port, she laughed loud laughter three. But when she came to the gallows foot, the tears blinded her ee. Yestreen the queen had four Marys. The night she'll hae but three. There was Mary Seaton, and Mary Beaton, and Mary Carmichael, and me. Now there's another one that tells a story. The Princess and the Gypsies by Francis Cornford.
As I looked out one May morning, I saw the treetops green. I said, my crown I will lay down and live no more a queen. Then I tripped down my golden steps, dressed in my silken gown. And when I stood in the open wood, I met some gypsies brown. Oh, gentle, gentle gypsies that roam the wide world through, because I hate my crown and state, oh, let me come with you. If you would come along with us, then you must count the cost. For though in spring the sweet birds sing, in winter comes the frost. Your ladies serve you all the day with courtesy and care. Your fine-shod feet they tread so neat, but a gypsy's feet go bare. You wash in water running warm through basins all of gold. The streams where we roam have silvery foam, but the streams are cold. And barley bread is bitter to taste, while sugary cakes they please. Which will you choose? Oh, which will you choose? Which will you choose of these? For if you choose the mountain streams and barley bread to eat, your heart will be free as the birds in the tree, but the stones will cut your feet. And though your heart grow deep and gay, your heart grow wise and rich, the cold will make your bones to ache, and you will die in a ditch. Oh, gentle, gentle gypsies that roam the wide world through, although I praise your wandering ways, I dare not come with you. I hung about their fingers brown my ruby rings and chain, and with my head as heavy as lead I turned me back again. As I went up the palace steps, I heard the gypsies laugh. The birds of spring so sweet did sing, it broke my heart in half.
Now we've got two nursery rhymes. One a little tiny one called Wee Bit Moosicky.
There was a wee bit moosicky that lived in Gilberatio. It couldn't get a bite of cheese for cheaty pussy catio. It said unto the cheesicky, oh, fain would I be at ye, oh, if werena for the cruel paws of cheaty pussy catio.
The cow who jumped over the moon remarked, gazing up at the sky, I think I shall try those Olympics. There's no one as clever as I. If I were to enter the high jump, I'd be sure of a medal, you see. Or is it grammatically better to say there's no one as clever as me? The head of the herd, called Daisy, methodically chewing the cud, said, you haven't jumped over the moon, my dear, since eons before the flood. And though it was perfectly splendid, I must proffer a slight demur. What I am trying to say is, you are not as young as you were. And as far as I can remember, that dog was a bit of a flop. I'm all for some laughter and jollity, but he never knew when to stop. And the dish and the spoon were disgraceful. They caused most fearful to do. There hasn't been quite such a rumpus since that woman who lived in that shoe. The cow who jumped over the moon replied, giving a tentative hop, there may be something in what you say, it's a long way over the top. I fear I shall have to forego the fame and the dais with me in the middle, and the flags and the crowds and the cheers and the praise and the band playing Hey Diddle Diddle. The head of the herd, called Daisy, said with a satisfied glance, "Your nobleness does you credit, but one must give the heifers a chance. And thanks to your shining example, some of them aren't too dud." And with this selfless decision, they both returned to chewing the cud. No one really seems to know who wrote this next piece. Rumor has it that it was found by the friend of a friend of a friend of a friend in a parish magazine. But perhaps somebody may claim it. It's called "The Lord Said Unto Noah." "The Lord said unto Noah, where is the ark I commanded you to build? And Noah said, verily I have had three carpenters off sick. The gopher wood supplier hath let me down. Yea, even though the gopher wood hath been on order for nigh upon 12 months. The damp course specialist hath not turned up. And God said to Noah, I want the ark finished before 7 days and 7 nights. Noah said, it will be so, but it was not so. The Lord said to Noah, what seems to be the trouble this time? Noah said, my subcontractor hath gone bankrupt. The pitch for the outside of the ark hath not arrived. The glazier departeth on holiday to Majorca. Yea, even though I offered him double time. Shem hath formed a pop group with his brothers Ham and Japheth. Lord, I am undone. And the Lord grew angry and said, what about the animals? Two of every sort I've ordered to come to be kept alive. Where, for example, are the giraffes? And Noah said, they've been delivered to the wrong address, but they should arrive by Friday. And the Lord said to Noah, where are the monkeys and the elephants and the zebras? Noah said, they are expected today. And the Lord said, how about the unicorns? And Noah wrung his hands and wept. Oh, Lord. Lord, they are a discontinued line. Thou canst not get unicorns for love or money. Thou knowest how it is. And the Lord said, Noah, my son, I know. Why else dost thou think I have caused a flood? This is called Welsh Incident, and it's by Robert Graves.
But that was nothing to what things came out from the sea caves of Cricket yonder.
What were they? Mermaids? Dragons? Ghosts?
Nothing at all of anything like that.
What were they then?
All sorts of queer things. Things never seen or heard or written about. Very strange, un-Welsh, utterly peculiar things. Oh, solid enough they seem to touch. Had anyone dared it? Marvelous creation, all various shapes and sizes, and no sizes, all new, each perfectly unlike his neighbor, though all came moving slowly out together.
Describe just one of them.
I am unable.
What were their colors?
Mostly nameless colors. Colors you'd like to see. But one was puce. Or perhaps more like crimson. But not purplish. Some had no color.
Tell me, had they legs?
Not a leg nor foot among them that I saw.
But did these things come out in any order? What o'clock was it? What was the day of the week? Who else was present? How was the weather?
I was coming to that. It was 3:30 on Easter Tuesday last. The sun was shining. The Harrach Silver Band played Machog Yessi on 37 shimmering instruments, collecting for Carnarvon's fever hospital fund. The populations of Old Helle, Crickith, Porthmadoc, North, Tremadoc, Penryn, Dydraith were all assembled. Crickith's mayor addressed them first in good Welsh and then in fluent English, twisting his fingers in his chain of office, welcoming the things. They came out on the sand, not keeping time to the band, moving seaward silently at a snail's pace. But at last, the most odd, indescribable thing of all, which hardly one man there could see for wonder, did something, recognizably a something.
Well? What?
It made a noise.
A frightening noise?
No.
A musical noise? A noise of scuffling?
No. But a very loud, respectable noise. Like groaning to oneself on Sunday morning in chapel, close before the second psalm.
What did the mayor do?
I was coming to that.
Now, some poems I think really ought to be shouted. Well, I don't mean shouted, perhaps I mean sort of chanted, so that one gets the lilt and the swing of them, almost like a song. So we're going to read Tartary by Walter de la Mare.
If I were lord of Tartary, myself and me alone, my bed should be of ivory, of beaten gold my throne. And in my court should peacocks flaunt, and in my forests tigers haunt, and in my pools great fishes slant their fins athwart the sun.
If I were lord of Tartary, trumpeters every day to all my meals should summon me, and in my courtyard bray, and in the evening lamps should shine yellow as honey, red as wine, while harp and flute and mandolin made music sweet and gay.
If I were lord of Tartary, I'd wear a robe of beads, white and gold and green they'd be, and small and thick as seeds. And ere should wane the morning star, I'd don my robe and scimitar, and zebra seven should draw my car through Tartary's dark glades.
Lord of the fruits of Tartary, her rivers silver pale.
Lord of the hills of Tartary, glen, thicket, wood and dale.
Her flashing stars, her scented breeze.
Her trembling lakes like foamless seas.
Her bird-delighting citron trees in every purple veil.
Now to finish, I will read Farewell by Walter de la Mare. When I lie where shades of darkness shall no more assail mine eyes, nor the rain make lamentation when the wind sighs, how will fare the world whose wonder was the very proof of me? Memory fades, must the remembered perishing be? Oh, when this my dust surrenders, hand, foot, lip to dust again, may these loved and loving faces please other men. May the rusting harvest hedgerow still the traveller's joy entwine, and as happy children gather, poses once mine. Look thy last on all things lovely every hour. Let no night seal thy sense in deathless slumber, till to delight thou have paid thy utmost blessing, since that all things thou wouldst praise, beauty took from those who loved them in other days.
With Great Pleasure was presented by Dame Celia Johnson in company with David Davis and Rosalind Shanks before an invited audience at the Kenton Theatre, Henley-on-Thames. The producer from Bristol was Brian Patton.